counsel. Members of the court, my name is John Vaught. I'm with Wheeler, Traeger, O'Donnell, and I represent Financial Indemnity Company that I refer to as FIC. And with me is Drew Unthank, my colleague at Wheeler, Traeger. Also is my client, Robin Davis, who is the Vice President of Liability Claims at FIC. What is significant about this case, but more importantly, what is undisputed about this case, is that our policyholder, Mitchell Oliver, sat at a table probably no larger than the table that's in this courtroom, and across that table in a face-to-face meeting with his insurance agent that he dealt with for a number of years, they discussed the purchase of an FIC policy of automobile insurance. And in that discussion, a face-to-face meeting, they talked about not only APIP, but basic PIP in Colorado, and a low-cost option available based on economic factors. And in the process, they talked specifically about the APIP coverage, and using a matrix that was available to the insurance agent, went down the type of coverages that were available to Mr. Oliver. If he purchased APIP coverage, they discussed the cost, and they discussed who would be covered, including people like Mr. Hudgens, his guest passengers. And in the context of that...
Excuse me, counsel, sorry to interrupt, but the policy does not include guest passengers, though, under the APIP coverage, does it?
Well, Your Honor, we would contend because it says, and of course, coverage for APIP is a statutory coverage, and it's always read into a policy. We know that from Brennan. But the record in this case is that our claims policy was to pay those claims, and the agent's uncontested testimony is, I know I discussed guest passengers, and she said, I'm not sure at this moment whether I talked about pedestrians. But that was the context of that meeting. And at the end of that meeting, Mr. Oliver rejected APIP coverage as too expensive. Not only that, he rejected basic PIP coverage that 99% of Coloradans carried under the No Fault Act. And instead, he opted for a low liability coverage, PIP coverage rather, that is available only if you qualify under the federal policy guidelines and make $11,000 a year. And in that context, it was in that context that Judge Rappaport, in a decision unlike any other in Colorado or in the Tenth Circuit, she applied a different standard and refused to look at the offer at all. No evidence whatsoever allowed to be presented about that offer. She refused to follow at the time binding precedent in Munger and later Jewett when she made her rulings, and she fashioned essentially a strict liability standard in Colorado based solely upon policy language. And in doing so, we contend she ignored the No Fault Act and the ruling in Munger, among others, requiring a review of the totality of the circumstances of that offer. She ignored Section 10's three requirements, and in my opinion, there are only three requirements under 710. And she ignored any requirement of showing proximate causation. But equally important, Your Honors, that while all of these reasons suggest reformation was inappropriate, whether you accept that reformation was right or wrong, Munger and Jewett underscore that defenses to that ruling by Judge Rappaport were and remain to this day debatable, which is the standard that says, as a matter of law, we could not have committed bad faith in that process. But let's make no mistake, this is a statutory construction case. Because without Section 710, there would be no requirement whatsoever to even mention a PIP at the sales table when you buy PIP coverage. And certainly there would be, without 710, no obligation to make an offer. And so the question becomes, what does 710 require? Because remembering that the first rule of statutory construction is read the statute, and no one has contended thus far that it is ambiguous, 710 requires only three things. It requires an offer over a policy containing basic PIP and liability. That's the defined term complying policy, a policy containing basic PIP and liability. And it requires an offer of unlimited medical benefits, or at the option of the policyholder, an offer of unlimited medical benefits plus additional wage benefits. That's it. Those are the provisions of 710, and 710 says nothing about EIPs. And the reason, I think, seems clear, and really addresses your concern, Judge Miller, that because all PIP coverage is a statutory creature, who is covered by PIP is determined by that statute. It's not negotiable at the sales table. You can't pick and choose. If you buy APIP coverage, you're going to buy coverage dictated in the statute. And Brennan tells us that. 710 offer simply does not compel a discussion of EIPs in the offer process. Those EIPs are essentially set in statutory stone. But let's step back, because not only does 710 not require an identification of EIPs, eligible injured persons, the No-Fault Act doesn't require that eligible injured persons be identified in the policy itself. There is nothing in the No-Fault Act that says thou must identify EIPs in the policy, because if you buy APIP coverage, the statute determines who has that coverage.
So Mr. Vaught,
yes.
If a carrier issues a policy that the language of which is totally non-compliant with the Auto Accident Reparations Act, doesn't comply in any respect, your position is that doesn't matter because the policy is deemed by law to incorporate the minimum requirements of the statute.
No, it does matter, Your Honor, because it's possible that you could violate 710 if your policy, if for example, you don't make an offer, as is the case in Thompson. That's element number one of 710. If you don't make an offer, that's a different ballgame. We also know that at least the 10th Circuit, and Jewett has made reference to that, has recognized a situation in which you attempt to impose an exclusion, you might well violate the No-Fault Act and therefore not make an appropriate offer. But beyond that, I mean, what I'm saying is 710 doesn't require you to identify the EIPs. I think the insurance carrier who chooses to say, we exclude coverage for pedestrians, is probably running a risk in this state and certainly running a risk in the 10th Circuit.
Pardon me, Mr. Vaught.
Yes.
I understand your argument about 710, but do cases like Parfrey require such an advisement?
Of EIPs?
Yes, sir.
Well, Your Honor, I think what we have to recognize is we're trying to take a test applicable to UM and make it work at PIP, and I have no problem with that. But what we've got to be careful about is applying the totality of the circumstances test can't expand the elements of 710. The legislature has said what has to be disclosed under 710. So the way the totality of the circumstances would work in PIP cases is as it did here. Did Mr. Oliver reasonably understand under the totality of the circumstances that he could buy additional medical benefits, or he could buy at his option additional medical benefits plus wage loss? Do I technically believe that price, for example, has to be part of the totality of the circumstances? No, I don't think it does, because it's not required in 710. Is it good business practice? It probably is. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we can't expand 710 by throwing the door open on the totality of the circumstances test. But under the test here, applied here, there is no dispute that Mr. Oliver walked away from that table understanding he could buy. And he could buy that additional coverage. And in this case, he was told what it would cost. He was told who would cover, and he was given a matrix to explain it. So academically, I may have one answer. Our record reflects that he met all of those tests and the totality of the circumstances. But let me turn, if I could, to the constitutional issue just briefly, because I want to make a point about it. And whether we view this as a windfall recovery for Mr. Hudgens simply because a flaw has allegedly been found in the policy, or whether we look at it as a penalty imposed by an insurance company because of an alleged problem in its policy that didn't harm anyone. The problem here really is that the judge failed to apply any proximate cause analysis. And had she gone on and applied the totality of the circumstances test, as Munger says, it's possible she would have addressed it. But it's not enough to find, oh, there's a flaw in the policy, and therefore we can impose any penalty we want on FIC. The court has to go through that proximate cause analysis, and the totality of the circumstances test, had it been applied here, might well have cured that problem. We don't know. Let me also talk about the bad faith and the willful and wanton failure to pay benefits, because these issues, of course, from the case law will fall under their own weight if reformation is reversed. But
so before we get to those things, Mr. Vaught, sorry to interrupt.
Certain.
But let's assume for purposes of argument that we agree with you that the jury should have been allowed to hear the facts of this offer and then the rejection by Mr. Oliver. What relief should that bring us to give you?
Well,
what should we do?
I think that in this case, the record is sufficiently clear that there are no disputed issues of material fact that an offer was made that would meet the totality of the circumstances. So we don't think you need to do anything other than remand for judgment to be entered on behalf of the FIC. But if what you're suggesting is, do we send it back for a new trial? And the new trial then determines, and it's an equitable process, and I'm not going to take a position yet because I don't really know what I would say about this yet. It could be that is an equitable proceeding that may or may not get to the jury on those considerations, but let's assume it does appropriate to go to the jury. The question would be, was a reasonable offer made, and did he understand he could buy it? That's really it. But I was saying that bad faith claims and willful and wanton claims would fall under their own weight because in this case, any pre-Reformation conduct, FIC was excused. It was told you not acted in bad faith prior to the Reformation. So the sole issue on the bad faith claim was whether when we chose not to pay a debatable Reformation order that was interlocutory, did that constitute bad faith? And I think the answer is, it can't possibly, because bad faith in that case, first of all, has to be a question of law, is if you don't pay in the face of an interlocutory order, is that order binding? Is not something I think the jury could possibly decide. But having said that, if in fact we have a debatable defense that is not baseless, and I think it is clear that's where we are, then we can't, as a matter of law, have committed bad faith.
Counsel, I want to ask a question about your response to Judge Bernard. I think you said that the proper thing to do would be to remand this and with the directions for the court to enter judgment in favor of FIC.
Based upon the record, yes.
Well, that's not what you asked for in the brief, though, as I understand it. You asked for that the Reformation order be reversed and that there be a new trial. I didn't think you were appealing the denial of your motion for summary judgment, but is that the position you're taking?
Judge, that's my position. I can't tell you what exactly said in the brief. I thought certainly we had said we believe this record is clear right now that an offer was made.
Well, my understanding is that the affidavit of the agent was that I would have done all these things. I recall meeting with Mr. Oliver, and I would have done this, I would have done that. In the ordinary course, I do these things, which may create a genuine issue of material fact, but is that a sufficient basis for us to enter, for a court to enter judgment?
Our original judge said no, and so what happened was Mitchell Oliver then came forward with his own affidavit and confirmed what the agent had said. That's what was not available when the first motion for summary judgment was filed, was what Mitchell Oliver said. A second motion for summary judgment was filed in which his affidavit was presented that says, yes, that's what was discussed, and I rejected this coverage. So we now have both sides of that offer by affidavit, just that Judge Rappaport refused to look at it. So I have only a little time left here, but on attorney's fees, very quickly, it is a creature of statute here. You can only get fees on the basis of the no-fault statute. It is solely to recover benefits. And so as a result, there's two requirements. Both are statutory and can be reviewed de novo. This is not an abuse of discretion question. She had to apply the statute, had to apply the statute's formula. The first was, assuming that you have some entitlement to fees, is a formula. Because plaintiff's counsel are forced before trial to say, what are the benefits you seek? In this case, they said $1.6 million and change. Then they compare that with the final judgment, said, what were the benefits you recovered? In this case, $100,000. 6.1% of fees spent on the recovery of benefits is all they can get. But perhaps more importantly than that, and the court says this is not a matter of just awarding fees based on the value presented at counsel. This only can be awarded for actual fees spent. So Mr. Hudgens has to show either he wrote a check or a contingent fee agreement took money away from him. And we had no such contingent fee in this case. All we have is just speculation about that agreement. There is no proof that Mr. Hudgens paid anything for attorney's fee. All right, I'm going to reserve the last 30 seconds here address the $200,000 cap in the event that Mr. Sargent in his cross appeal addresses that. Thank you.
Good May it please the court, I'm Walter Sargent. I represent the plaintiff, Drexel Hudgens. I want to focus first on the reformation issues. I think I need to emphasize that FIC is asking this court to make a dramatic change in the law that has serious implications for a number of injured people, and I want to be crystal clear about where the law currently stands and where FIC wants it to go. Now, I don't think there's much dispute that the twin pillars of Section 710 Reformation Law are this court's decisions in Thompson versus Budget Rent-A-Car and Brennan versus Farmers Alliance. Thompson was decided in 1996, Brennan was decided in 1998, Cert was denied in both cases. Both cases have been cited in many opinions. They've withstood the test of time. They've never been limited. They've never been overruled. Now, Judge Capelke's opinion in Thompson included two rulings that are pertinent here. First, it completely disposed of the argument that an injured passenger lacks standing to assert that the driver's insurer failed to comply with Section 710. And second, it held that when the insurer fails to offer APIP coverage in compliance with Section 710, that coverage is incorporated into the policy by operation of law, regardless of the party's intent. And the opinion is absolutely clear that it doesn't matter if the insurer produces affidavits or any other evidence that the policyholder wouldn't have purchased the additional coverage if it had been offered in compliance with Section 710. That evidence, the court said, doesn't even create a factual issue for a jury, not merely because it would be speculative, but also because, quote, it would allow insurers to circumvent the intent of the legislature. And for the past 13 years, courts have adhered to Thompson, even where the policyholder declined to purchase any APIP coverage at all. And that's virtually every case except for Brennan. Clark, Morris, Warren, even where the policyholders not only declined APIP coverage, but also said they didn't want it and they couldn't afford it. And that's the Fincher case. If the offer didn't strictly comply with Section 710, the policy had to be reformed to include that coverage. Now, Judge Davidson's opinion in Brennan reaffirmed Thompson, but added a very important holding. It said to comply with Section 710, the offer of APIP coverage can't just be for named insureds and their relatives. The offer has to cover pedestrians and guest occupants. And if the offer doesn't include them, the policy has to be reformed to include them. And after Cert was denied in Brennan in August of 1998, it was clear to most people who follow PIP law in Colorado that insurers who hadn't been offering APIP coverage for guest occupants and pedestrians better change their policy forms. They better send out notices to their current policyholders advising them that they're offering this new APIP coverage, because otherwise the policies would get reformed to include APIP coverage for everyone. Some people apparently didn't get the message, including one insurance company. And in January 2000, almost 2 years after Brennan, Michael Oliver visited Dora Chavez about getting some auto insurance. And she sold him a policy from FIC, a company that still hadn't revised its policies, that still wasn't offering APIP for guest occupants and pedestrians. Its policy form still restricted APIP coverage to named insureds and relatives. Its application documents still didn't show APIP coverage for pedestrians and guest occupants. And I'm not sure if I misspoke there. I meant to say the policy forms were restricted to the named insureds and relatives. And although the affidavits of Michael Oliver and Dora Chavez say that Chavez went over all the available options for additional coverage, they don't say that she ever offered APIP coverage for pedestrians and guest passengers. She couldn't. It wasn't available from FIC. FIC suggests that by adopting Parfrey's totality of the circumstances test, this court in Munger may have sort of loosened up the standards for Section 10 offers a bit. But that's not correct. The totality of the circumstances test simply says that if the insurer has offered the APIP coverage described in Section 710, we still have to consider whether the offer was available to inform the policyholder of the availability of that coverage to purchase. In Munger, this court found that the insurer's mailings to an existing policyholder about newly available APIP options were not adequate to inform the policyholder of the new APIP options. In Jewett, conversely, this court found that the insurer's mailings to an existing policyholder, at least a dozen mailings, were adequate to inform the policyholder of the newly available APIP options. But neither of those cases, and none of the 10th Circuit cases cited by FIC, holds that an offer of APIP coverage that doesn't comply with Section 10 can nevertheless be sufficient under the totality of the circumstances.
Mr. Sergeant, may I interrupt you for a moment? My question is this. We have affidavits from Mr. Oliver and from Ms. Chavez that reflect at least some offer was made. Some kind of a conversation occurred about the availability of APIP. Is that correct?
Or APIP supplemental PIP coverage, yes, some sort of offer.
But yet the trial court's decision wasn't based on whether that offer was adequate or not. The trial court's decision was based upon the actual policy itself as opposed to the offer. What are we to do with that?
Well, it was based on the policy, and then on reconsideration, and I would like to point out to the court the trial court's order, the post-trial, on denying the Rule 59 motion. The court said also the application documents didn't say anything about APIP coverage. But even in the affidavits of Chavez and Michael Oliver, they don't say that she made an offer that included guest occupants and pedestrians. They don't say that. They simply say, I went over all the options that we had, all the available options. But there's nothing in the record that indicates that there was ever an offer for APIP coverage for guest occupants.
Well, if that's the case, I mean, we've got a statement that an offer was made. Were there any responding affidavits saying that no, it wasn't, or no, it wasn't sufficient, or was it based solely upon what the policy itself said?
The policy, and of course also, as I said, I mean, the documents indicating that that there is no available APIP coverage.
Why doesn't that create an issue of fact? Why could the court grant summary judgment based just on that? I mean, in the face of an affidavit that says there was a discussion.
We don't deny that there was a discussion. We don't deny that there was a discussion about supplemental PIP. What we deny is that there was an offer of supplemental PIP, of APIP, that conformed with Section 710, including guest occupants and pedestrians. There's absolutely no evidence.
Why is that an issue of fact? I'm struggling with that because it seems like that's a central issue of fact. What offer was made? What did it contain? Who said what to whom? Did it comply or did it not? Are those stipulated facts?
Well, it's stipulated that, it's of course stipulated that the policy did not conform with Section 710. Now, the only evidence of FIC's insurance coverage was the policy. And as I said, there's no evidence to suggest that there was ever an offer that included more coverage than FIC was making available in its policies.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Sergeant, on that particular point. We know that the document does not contain this information. But assume for purposes of argument, I know you disagree with this, but assume for purposes of argument, it was crystal clear that everything you say should have been given to Mr. Oliver was given to him in a oral offer. And he was told, you can do this, you can have APIP, it applies to EIPs, went down the whole list. Let's assume that. I know you disagree with it, but let's assume that. Would that be sufficient to establish adequate compliance by FIC?
I don't think it would, Your Honor, because, of course, an offer requires that something be presented for acceptance. And FIC was not making available APIP coverage in conformance with Section 710. Dora Chavez was simply an independent sales agent. I don't think that she could bind FIC to coverages that it never even offered. And, well, I guess I'll leave it at that.
Does the plaintiff dispute that, in fact, FIC did pay to APIP benefits for injured guests and pedestrians, which is what Mr. Vaughton was arguing?
Well, what he said was that for people who purchased APIP,
yes.
That is undisputed. Now, as we pointed out in our brief, the testimony also says that the same person couldn't recall any case where they'd actually done that. But they said we've never not done it. But okay. We do have a quarrel with the court's opinion in one respect, of course, and that's the imposition of the $200,000 cap. The court found that the issue was governed by Brennan, where the policy already contained a $200,000 cap on PIP benefits, and not by Thompson, where there was no cap on PIP benefits. But as this court said in Snipes versus American Family, whether APIP under the reformed policy is subject to a cap depends on the language in the original policy. In Brennan, the APIP endorsement contained a cap of $200,000, quote, on the aggregate amount payable. Here, the policy said that the maximum aggregate amount payable to you or a relative shall not exceed $200,000. There was no aggregate cap applicable to all eligible injured persons. And as we pointed out in a reply in support of our cross appeal, the Tenth Circuit's very recent opinion in Warren versus Liberty Mutual acknowledges this very point. Reformation merely corrects the defect. And here, that's the failure to offer APIP for pedestrians and guest passengers. But reformation doesn't add caps where they don't exist. So the trial court erred in imposing a $200,000 cap. And I would especially like to direct this court's attention in the Warren case, which came out after our principal brief, but before Appellant's reply brief, and we included in our reply in support of the cross appeal. But it also addresses other issues that have been raised by the appellants, for example, that you or your family members or you or your relatives by implication excludes others. I'm not sure that they're even contesting that right now. I'd like to turn to a
Could
couple
I ask
of
you a question?
Yes.
I did not find the declaration page in the record, or at least in the record on the motion for partial summary judgment. Is that a part of the record?
The declaration in the original policy?
Yes, sir.
I don't know, Your Honor.
Is that necessary in order to determine what the aggregate cap is?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, the policy, as I say, I mean, just it says specifically $200,000. An aggregate cap, whatever the language is, for you and your relatives. That's in the policy, and whether there's no other evidence to the contrary.
And you mentioned Tenth Circuit cases, but doesn't Stickley say when you do reformation, you reform only the defective portion? You don't. That doesn't mean you write from a clean slate and rewrite the entire policy to give the plaintiff all of the possible benefits that there could have been.
I want to be careful in answering your question because I'm not entirely sure what you're driving at. We are saying that.
But both Stickley and Warren basically say if the original cap is set at $200,000 on the original policy, that applies to APIP. You don't selectively reform part of the policy. You have to live with that aggregate cap. Isn't that what those two cases stand for?
Well, in No, I think in I think the court is correct in saying that you only reform the defective portion, and I guess I'm not entirely clear what you're saying. There was no aggregate cap of $200,000 on basic PIP. Basic PIP was just $100,000. I'm not sure.
Well, there was a $200,000. You were saying there's a $200,000 cap, but it's limited to just insured and resident relatives, right?
That's correct.
So that $200,000, so if you're reforming the policy to include others, namely guests and pedestrians, under Warren and Stickley, that $200,000 cap would apply to them as well.
I don't think so, Your Honor, I don't think that's what Warren is saying, and I don't think that's the implication, perhaps more importantly, of this court's opinion in Thompson, and I understand there are other differences between this case and Thompson, but...
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Mills, some very quick points here. It is undisputed. The testimony is that it was the policy of the company. Its claims practice was to pay pedestrians and guest passengers at that time. That was the testimony and is acknowledged. It's undisputed. Second, $200,000 cap in this case was in the policy, not on the deck page, although we believe the deck page is in the record. The $200,000 cap appears in the policy itself. Also, Judge Miller, at page 6 of our opening brief, we asked there for relief there, for remand, for entry of judgment in FIC's favor. And last point is, even if reformation stands in this case, which we believe is not appropriate, that we are entitled to a reversal on the bad faith extra contractual claims in this case, because this appeal and the entire process in the face of this interlocutory order has been absolutely in good faith. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. That concludes the arguments for this morning's docket. The court will be in recess. Bailiff may so announce.